time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, Joe Scott Coe. Joe Scott Coe is an assistant professor of English at Riverside Community College in Southern California. Her essays on education, gender, and violence have been published in numerous publications, including the Los Angeles Times, Fourth Genre, Green Mountain Review, Babel Fruit, Narrative Magazine, and the anthology Reinterpretations, The Shapes of Justice in Women's Experience. In 2009, she received a Pushcart special mention in nonfiction, as well as a notable listing in Best American Essays. And she is here to talk about her new book, Teacher at Point Blank, Confronting Sexuality, Violence, and Secrets in a Suburban School, which was just picked as a great read for fall by Ms. Magazine. Joe, thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here in Seattle.
Start out, tell us, what was your motivation in writing Teacher at Point Blank?
Wow. Well, many motivations. I think that my first motivation was that after teaching for 11 years and after the passage of the No Child Left Behind Act, and thinking about why I had gone into teaching, which was to teach as a thinking person who had a life of the mind, who wanted to continue writing, who wanted to bring that energy into my teaching, I realized that that was starting to be disincentivized, even very early. You know, teachers were being pressed to scrap novels, for example, in literature classes because that wouldn't help the test scores. And then when we talked about it, we were kind of summarily disciplined, chided, and I realized that this was not a healthy environment. I had a couple of strange incidents with students, one which turned out kind of in a beautiful way, and another which got very creepy. And I realized that in some ways I was behaving as an abused person, and I was starting to doubt myself, doubt my judgment, and to get healthy, I needed to step away, I needed to remember, I needed to think about and connect my experience to other people's experience, and so that's why I wrote the book.
All right, and you first started teaching at the school where you'd been a student. Tell us how that came about.
Well, what's interesting is that that was not my plan. You know, originally I had this idea I was going to not live in Southern California. That was where I had been living, and that I was going to go back east, and that didn't happen because I didn't have the money to move. And so I also did not plan to go back to my alma mater, and I, which, by the way, I don't identify in the book. If people know me, that means that they've done their homework, but I really am not trying to overemphasize that location. The place where I really was interested in teaching was a high school across town, and there were openings that closed, and so the only place where there were openings was at the place where I had been a student. So I applied and I got the job. I already had a reputation there. So in some ways I was lucky because I already knew things that new teachers often don't. I knew, you know, where things were. I already, you know, I was kind of liked at this school. I had been an obedient, dutiful student for the most part, kind of sassy at times, but, you know, basically a good kid. So I started in a kind of familiar environment. But then what was interesting was experiencing it as an adult, which is a whole other thing. So part of it, the work in the book is integrating those points of view and thinking about, wow, did we, you know, is this really a grown-up environment? Is this really an environment for adulthood or not? And so the infantilization of teachers and teaching became really interesting to me, you know.
So when did you, I don't know, start having second thoughts or feeling like things weren't quite as you had imagined they would be?
Well, it's interesting because a lot was going on in my family. My father left when I had just started teaching. I mean, it was like 6 weeks into my job. You know, he came over to the house and he was leaving in my family. I don't know where my dad lives. I don't know where my father is now. So that was kind of, I would say, traumatic. My sister was still at the high school. And I was in a relationship for a really long time that was, in a way, kind of, I don't know, unhealthy connection. And so I think part of where I started to get the itch around 7 years, there's a chapter in the book called The 7 Year Itch, was when I started to get to feel like myself and to realize maybe who I was and how I could behave in more healthy ways. And I actually took a year off of teaching. I worked in a print factory. strange, but I fell in love with someone who was healthy, who could see me, and I was able to see him. And then I started, again, it's just interesting how when you're ready to see things differently, you start going, God, you know, I'm good at teaching, but maybe this situation is a match for my dependencies instead of my strength. So what's that about? And I started getting really interested in how teachers sometimes were self-silencing or were punishing in silences with each other. If someone would speak to something, someone might slap them down. You know, it's 8 out of 10 teachers are women overall in English departments. It's a lot of women. And I think sometimes women have difficulties with adult mentorship. It's a problem. I mean, it can happen, but there's often, especially if you're in a low-status profession, it's difficult. So I would say around year 7, I really started kind of looking around and thinking, because I was trying to get my own life in order and in kind of my emotional center. And I started noticing, gee, if I'm centered and I'm sane, this is feeling less healthy. Why? What is that about? So that continued to nag at me. I came back to the school, and then after No Child Left Behind and after some other things that were going on, it was just like, you know, I need to apply my writing to this. I need to reflect on this with more depth. And I can't do it and continue to do this work at the moment. So that's what I did.
So I imagine that it had to be really painful to leave something that you were really attached to.
It was painful, but it was also mindful. I mean, you know, the most tangible thing is, you know, you're walking away from your reputation that you have at the school. You know, people know you. They don't understand. Even if you explain to them, it's like, what are you doing? I don't get it. You know, there's that part. So that's weird to kind of have to re-explain that. You know, financially, it was a big cost. I mean, my husband at the time was a part-time college teacher himself, and we both really agreed as a team that in order for me to teach again, because I wanted to continue to teach, it was just like, I need to think about how and why I'm doing this and what is this? So, it was scary. I mean, it's kind of like, oh, you know, it's excitement feeling, but like, I don't know. And so part of it was this idea of I need to discover, I need to reflect. So I was able to, I got a small fellowship. It did not offset the blow to our income really at all, but it at least kept me from having to take out student loans. We had other kinds of debt during that period. But, and so I was able to really concentrate on writing, and I work with some great writers, at the University of California, Riverside, which is kind of like, who is that? Where is that? You know, I don't care. I just knew what I needed to work on. So,
so talk about what was it like? It seems that, you basically went back to your alma mater 4 years or thereabouts after.
Yeah, it was exactly
so
4 years.
That
really
seems
close.
Pretty young to be walking back into a school that you just recently left.
Right. Oh, yeah. I mean, I was very mindful of my youth, you know, my femaleness. I had a very conservative upbringing. So I think that in a weird way, I mean, not in a weird way, I think that was an incredible advantage because I had a real kind of clear understanding about certain kinds of social expectations that other people might have, right? And so when I was requesting classes, I requested all freshmen. And of course, the principal was thrilled because nobody wants all freshmen. I consider freshmen, you know, very alive. They're sometimes the least dead. Of course, they're very kinetic, and that can be, you know, a problem. But I also, in terms of strategy, I wanted the biggest space in age because I knew that as a young person, as a young female, my authority was immediately going to be suspicious, you know. So I wanted at least a little bit more age difference so that it wasn't like, you know, necessarily the varsity football player, you know, kind of situation. I didn't have to deal with that my first year. So it was great, actually. It was great. The first couple of years I had some really great classes. You know, you teach in California, your caseload is, that first year was 180 human beings every day in and out of that classroom. Teachers don't often get told about caseload and what the impact of that is. We talk about class size, like it's geography or something, you know. I was very aware of gender. And so I was a hockey fan, so I immediately got the hockey poster up on the wall. And of course they, you know, what's that? And that was fun because then I could tell them about the Pittsburgh Penguins, you know, and this particular left wing. And then they're like, oh, she knows. She doesn't just think he's cute, you know. And that was important. So figuring out ways to kind of, again, it's jiu-jitsu sensei, you know, trying to diffuse tension as best you can, but trying to use your wits. I think I was very aware of needing to do that, understanding these are minds coming at you. They're going to bring in a lot of their own attitudes. And, you know, what can you do with that?
Well, hockey is interesting, too, because it seems like on a certain level that would send out a message that, you know, I'm ready to rumble if you...
Hanson Brothers, baby. I mean, slap shot, right? You know, oh, yeah. And so, but I mean, it wasn't an image of a body check, you know, full board, on, you know, that wasn't the image. But yeah, I mean, I think there's a sense, the one thing that young men get in sports is that, you know, sometimes it's actually detrimental, but the idea of you can walk it off, you can survive the injury, you can get through. And for me, in some weird way, I've always kind of, I think it's my Catholic upbringing, idea of patron saints, you know? So you need your hockey player, you need your intellectual, you need your spiritual guide, you know? And so, that image of a hockey player for me was fun. And, it actually provided a great conversation point. It had nothing to do with school.
So the examples you give in your book are both personal examples as well as, other people that you had worked with.
Yeah.
Talk about, again, both from when you first started and as it changed over the years, the dynamics of, like, sexual tension and or that you deal with in the classroom and, you know, what's coming from guys is this constant, which seems like it's getting worse from my readings.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's true.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if it's worse or not. You know, you'd have to do a really huge longitudinal generational study. You'd have to look at diaries, for example, of one-room schoolhouse schoolmarms back in the 19th century on the frontier and see how were the plowboys treating her. You know, I mean, the suspicion of the female teacher goes back a long way. Teddy Roosevelt was worried about the effect of the female teacher on young men back when. So this is very old. Plus we have a you know, suspicion of teachers that actually comes out of our healthy American skepticism about authority. You know, it's why we revolted against England. So that's a big thumbs up. The problem is that females as mentors or females as grown-ups, it doesn't quite jibe with the image of the, you know, hot for teacher, sex kitten, playmate thing. So if you want to be a grown-up in a classroom with young men, sometimes they're attracted to you and it's actually sweet and you figure out a way not to be humiliating or shaming and you be gentle around that and help them use that energy for paying attention in class, you know, to getting their assignments done, just being kind to them. But sometimes the students don't know what to do with it, and it may be come out as hostility, and it comes out as challenging. It comes out sometimes in secret messages that come through assignments or through writings that are maybe directed at you as a challenge. What are you going to do about it? It might be sexual, violent. It might involve your name, the names of colleagues. And that can be very disturbing. Now, the interesting point is it's disturbing and also it's just a situation at that point, you know. What gets creepy is when you start to try to involve a community of other adults. This is where it's highly variable. So if you don't have an administrator you can go to without shame who's like, well, no, this is not okay. Or it becomes this big male posturing ritual thing and then it ends up still the blowback is on you. I mean, honestly, you know, pun intended in a way, you're still going to have to deal with this person. So if a parent runs interference, if the administrator doesn't take it seriously, or if they say, well, what did you do to make him call you a blank, you know, fill it in, or a coach, you know, if you want to involve all of the players in this person's life, it's not about incarceration. It's just about, you know, having a moment. And if you can't actually have a moment where what you experienced is acknowledged as real, then that's where, again, you get this domestic violence kind of ritual. Someone's telling you what you should and shouldn't be comfortable with, and that's not okay. So I think that now, especially, I think there is, I mean, Ariel Levy wrote this great book, Female Chauvinist Pigs, and it's kind of about how female sexual liberation, in a way, her thesis is that it's moved away from the intellectual tradition and it's kind of reenacted a certain kind of male fantasy that actually, again, it boomerangs back. It can hurt women because they're parroting, they're doing something that is acting out what other people expect instead of doing necessarily what they want to do. Do you want to be a stripper? Maybe you don't want to. Maybe you think you're supposed to. You know what I mean? It's a very interesting book. It's a great book. But anyway, so I've rambled a bit. But yeah, it's a concern. But I don't know that it necessarily is a new thing. I think that it's more sexualized. I think there's more enabling going on. How about that?
Okay, and the enabling is sounds like it's coming from multiple parties.
From parents. I mean, I had a weird situation with a student where, you know, after this long, torturous process of several weeks, and the student needed to be out of my class. I needed them out because it was accelerating. And we had to have a big conference because this isn't an honors class. Again, this is not your least smart student. This isn't a student among a clever cohort of peers. And when the parents say to me, we know that you're really nice and we don't want you to hurt his feelings. I mean, that's kind of that's was said to me in the meeting, and we can tell you're a good person. So you have to do what we say. And of course, in my mind, I'm thinking, are they afraid of their son? I mean, there's a whole other narrative there, of course, which I understand. But, you know, I did not waive my right to safety to do this job. So.
And did you, maybe not to that degree, did you find that was somewhat typical of parents' reactions for when they might disagree with either some amount of discipline that you tried to merit out, or even something like grades? You know, oh, you gave
grades.
Me a bad grade.
There, I have lots of stories about grade situations in there. I mean, you know, again, I think the suburban setting is where that's most likely to be a problem because you're most likely to be looked at as an indentured servant interloper. So if my son or daughter has to have such and such GPA to play sports or has to get into Yale or whatever the story is, whatever the agonistic scenario is, if you are in the way in any way, and even when you sit there and you say, I've looked at everything, we've re-looked at it, we've looked for points where there are no points, you know, this is the grade. And sometimes an administrator may order you. I mean, it's not necessarily that uncommon. Or someone may threaten you and you're like, you know what? I'm out of here. So sure. B minus. I mean, this does happen. Because again, the whole problem is adults running interference with other adults who need to have an impact on their kid. What's wrong with a B? What's wrong with a C plus? I'm sorry, but you know, it's like that, you know, people wonder why there's grade inflation. And I would say, well, you know, if you can't live with the grade that your student earns, or if you only care when the grade comes out, you know, then that's weird. It's the same thing with bullying as well. Like everyone's talking about bullying now. Bullying is not new, but you know, my teacher brain kicks in and says, well, if you only care about bullying, if your kid is bullied, but if you get the phone call, where someone says, you know, I saw something happen today, and then you're like, no, this couldn't possibly. Even if the child or the young person has said, I know, I'm sorry, it was wrong, and then the parent is running in between. I don't understand. I don't get that. I don't understand it. I mean, I do understand it, but that doesn't help. And so, again, then the bullying concern is lip service. So we get something awful like what happened at Rutgers, and aside from feeling this incredible sense of tragedy for the parents of the victim who committed suicide, and the sexual partner who is going to live with that for the rest of their lives, I'm thinking, this was not the first time those people were mean. That's pretty extreme. What the heck? When did maybe somebody raise a red flag and they were batted down? It's a question I have. I don't know. We'll never know unless they tell, and they probably won't. So it's the whole under the gun thing. The gun goes off at school and we go, oh my God, how could this happen? And of course I'm thinking as a teacher, how many signals, how many flags were disregarded, how many teachers felt like they didn't have anybody to talk to, students felt like they couldn't talk to teachers because teachers, when they go forward, maybe there's no backup, there's no coherent intervention, there's no counseling for disturbed students. I mean, our counseling ratios in California are obscene. So it's like, yeah, a gun's probably going to go off once in a while. I mean, I don't mean to be, you know, crass, but duh. You know, if you disregard and you have a punitive system where you're only worried about test scores, you're not worried about humanity in a school setting, bad things are going to happen there. it's going to be a fulfillment of all of your denial of that humanity. Something bad will happen in this place. And doesn't matter if it's the suburbs or the inner city.
So talk a little bit more about test scores and the testing companies. Do you see this as one of the...
Black helicopters. Okay.
One of the reasons why our schools across the country are turning out...
Well, I mean, the problem is, since No Child Left Behind, we have had... I mean, it's interesting. We've been talking about savings and loan and the, you know, the mortgage scams and the hedge fund scams and everything. And I'm going, wow, I've got a scam for you, you know. And that is this unregulated testing of our students who are captive. They are mandatory participants in a system that is required to use testing to assess whether the students are succeeding, with multiple choice instruments designed not by faculty, who are, by the way, grading and assessing all the time, but we don't trust their grades. So we have an unregulated test industry making money on assessing things that then we create data tables. I mean, there's a whole industry of mining the data. Seattle has just adopted a program that it's been used in Colorado. And when I see these things online, they look like video games and bubbles, and every school is a bubble, and every school has a grid, and, you know, and this is reading math and a writing sample. And I know those writing samples. I mean, they're, you know, it's a very formulaic kind of thing. There's no science. There's no art. There's no attendance rate. There's no how huge is this school. There's no how many kids were suspended. There's no how many parents are unemployed. You know, there's no coherent thing. It's just, oh, look, there's the data, so that we need to fix the data. It becomes then about the data. And it's interesting. If people really think about education as a matter of democracy and social justice, and even whether you're conservative or liberal, no regulation of some industry that's profiting on assessment that becomes the measuring stick that we tell whether we're doing a good job and then we flail ourselves with it. Wow, I mean, that seems like a bet on failure. You need the system to keep failing because it's highly profitable to continue that narrative. So, yeah, why no federal regulation of that, or at least oversight? Why is there no oversight of that? It's mandatory now everywhere. All students are being tested all the time. And so in California, we had the first group of students pass the high school exit exam on the first try. And I say, oh, no, not good. I teach community college now, and I have lots of students who pass their high school exit exam in remedial writing classes. And it's not the teacher's fault. The teachers have been bullied into teaching those kids to pass the tests. And the kids who really are disconnected from the academic culture come into community college, and they're like, what am I doing in a remedial class? I did what you told me. I passed the high school exit exam. How come I can't write? And the truth is, no one wants you to read or write or think or participate. We want you to buy things and to be frustrated generally and not know why and buy some more. And, you know, I think that's really a problem.
Sounds like a program that's also turning out basic robots to a degree.
Yeah. Oh, and we'll say it's critical thinking and, you know, independent people. And it's like, are you kidding? You know, I'm not seeing that. Teachers know this too. A smart teacher, the ninja teacher, you know, is trying to, you know, serve Peter and Paul, that whole game, right? Give unto Caesar the tests and try to sneak in some other things. But why should teachers have to do that? Why should good teaching have to be a sneaky thing? I mean, in a way, you're always kind of, you know, playing a poker game. You're trying to trick the students into things, right, that are wonderful, that they may be cynical about. There's that. But why, in terms of pedagogy, in terms of curriculum, in terms of the institution of school, should good teaching be considered bad teaching, and teaching towards a score be considered the highest honor? Schizophrenic.
I know there's also problems with the company that gives out those tests in terms of transparency. People have tried to get copies of the test, and
they refuse, trade secret
or whatever.
Right. There's that. There's also two of the biggest test operators are Educational Testing Service, ETS, and the College Board, which both are nonprofits, but they make a lot of money, and they have been critiqued for having a virtual monopoly on this industry. And so they don't have to report their income to the SEC, So they can, there are some really interesting things happening right now in terms of colleges. They're designing software for students to find out the total cost of different colleges, but colleges have to buy this from the College Board. Students will then have to use, so there are certain interesting ways in which the control of certain quote-unquote best practices or early beta technologies and so on gets controlled by a nonprofit. And then, of course, everyone has to have it, so that's interesting, too.
And the data mining aspect sounds pretty questionable as well.
Yeah.
All the potential corporations that could punch into that.
Yeah, I mean, and there are for-profits, too. I mean, you have Pearson, McGraw-Hill. They're part of giant conglomerates. A few years ago, back in, I think it was 2004, Seisint Industries purchased one of the big test corporations. I can't remember just off the top of my head. But Seisint was a developer of Matrix software for Homeland Security. So now they've split off. They have split. But that was when I saw that, I was in England at the time, and I'm like, no way, really? And then, yeah, of course, because it's all about technology. It's all about surveillance. I mean, testing as surveillance is a really interesting thing. Getting people used to being surveyed. I think that's part of it. And also getting people used to just bubbling it in without having to explain, without having to engage another human being. That trend is really disturbing and very reductive. So, yeah, it's.
Well, we only have a couple minutes left. So what changes, if you were put in charge of this at a top level, what changes would you try to implement?
Wow. The first thing that I would say is that we have to stop being solutions addicted without looking at the problem. Somebody asked me this the other day. And, you know, what's happened in medicine, you know, how HMOs have come between doctors and patients. We're seeing this in the classroom. Curriculum managers, you know, the person who's going to run the New York City schools is a former Hearst Corporation exec. And so, you know, we have people coming in between the teachers and the students. So I would say the first thing we have to do is stop just mining data and trying to fix test scores. And we really need to look at who people are in schools. This is more complicated. See, it would take much longer. It means you have to talk to veteran teachers who've been around a long time. You can't talk to the person who did a Teach for America internship and now wants to go run a program somewhere. You have to actually talk to people who are experienced. So that's what I would say. I mean, there is no magic wand. There's no red cape. There's no Superman. These are real teachers. These are real students. Not every dropout is a dropout for the same reason. Teachers' unions are not the enemy. There's maybe a union critique to be made, but we need to have a conversation about poverty, about joblessness, about our social net. And if we can't do that, I think it's going to be more of the same.
I'm not sure if it's the same in California, but I know here just locally in Bellevue, for instance, when you're talking about veteran teachers, they just basically did across the board cut of like all the veteran teachers as a cost savings, you know, move because, oh, they're costing us so much, you know, to keep them in there. If we bring in fresh young minds, it's a fraction of what we've been paying.
Right. Well, there are, for example, how much time do we have?
Because actually, we only got about 30 seconds.
Okay, so just really quickly, I mean, there is a whole for-profit college industry, you know, like your DeVry, your University of Phoenix, and they have all part-time faculty. So, you know, that's very cheap. There's no overhead. They have their thing, their college in a strip mall. There's no office hours. Everybody's part-time, so everyone's getting hourly, and then they encourage people to buy stock options, Enron-ish, as part of their salary. So just the move, again, away from mentorship and experience, I think, is bad. Youth is wonderful. We need it. But again, we need both. And I really think the disregard of veteran teachers is pretty obscene.
We're talking with Joe Scott Koh. She is author of the new book, Teacher at Point Blank, Confronting Sexuality, Violence, and Secrets in a Suburban School. And you have a couple of websites, and you're also going to be speaking today, later today, from 2 to 4 p.m. at Park Place Books, which is at 348 Park Place Center in Kirkland. And you have a couple of websites as well?
Yeah. You can find Teacher at Point Blank at Facebook. If you're not on Facebook, you can just go to joescottkoh.com and some of the wonderful Seattle media that we've had here the last couple days on the tour. You can find that there, as well as updates about other events and other fun stuff. So Please come visit, weigh in your voice, your comments, conversations, what we need.
Very good. Well, with that, I want to thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
Thanks for having me, Mike.